This is lecture number one by Robert Benoit on the major prophets. Lecture number one and subsequent lectures will deal with Isaiah. Lecture number one, Robert Benoit. We begin with Isaiah, and capital A of the outline is some comments on Isaiah the prophet himself. The meaning of the name Isaiah is, quote, salvation is of Yahweh, end quote. The name comes from the Hebrew word Yashah and Yahweh. Salvation is of Yahweh, or one could also translate this, quote, Yahweh is salvation, end quote. That's the meaning of his name. It occurs in several places in the Old Testament other than in the book of Isaiah as the name of an individual that quite clearly is not the same as the Isaiah who authored the prophecy of Isaiah. For example, in 1 Chronicles chapter 3:21, we read there, quote, the descendants of Hananiah, Pelatiah, and Jeshaiah, end quote. That Jeshaiah is the same name as Isaiah. It's just transliterated differently from the Hebrew to the English. In 1 Chronicles chapter 25, verse 23, you read a list of names. It's that Jeshaiah again, the same as the other one, but in Hebrew it's the name Isaiah. Down in verse 15, we read, quote, the eighth to Jeshaiah, his sons and relatives, end quote. All to say that the name Isaiah appears in various contexts other than in the book of Isaiah. So it does occur elsewhere. Thus, when you look at Isaiah chapter 1, verse 1, he is further identified as the son of Amos. I think we discussed this when we looked at the prophet Amos. But in Isaiah 1:1, we have Amos, not Amos. See the vision concerning Judah and Jerusalem that Isaiah, the son of Amos, saw. Isaiah the prophet is the son of Amos, which in Hebrew is spelled with a tzadeh and an aleph, whereas Amos, the prophet, has an ayin and a samek. So there is a difference in the spelling of the English word Amos and Amos. But this spelling is also different in Hebrew as well. We don't make much distinction of that in English when we pronounce the two words. We don't know anything about his father Amos. There is a rabbinical tradition that can be verified that Amos was the brother of King Amaziah of Judah. If that's the case, then Isaiah would have been the nephew of the king. But there's no real substantiating evidence for that other than that Jewish tradition. It seems that Isaiah lived in or near Jerusalem, because much of the setting when it appears for the various prophecies that he gives is near Jerusalem, particularly if you look at chapter 7. You read in chapter 7, verse 3, I quote, the Lord said to Isaiah, go out, you and your son, Shear Yashub, to meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the washerman's field, end quote. It is near the location of a water system that supplied water for Jerusalem. Later, in the time of Hezekiah, when the Assyrians attacked Jerusalem and surrounded it, Isaiah is called for by Hezekiah, and he seems to be in or near Jerusalem throughout most of the book. We know he was married and had at least two sons who were given symbolic names. The one we just mentioned there in Isaiah 7:3 is one of them. Let me quote again. The Lord said to Isaiah, go out, you and your son, Shear Yashub, end quote. Shear Yashub means, quote, the remnant will return, end quote. Shear means remnant, and Yashub, it comes from the Hebrew word shuv, which means to return. So the name means the remnant will return. And of course, that carries a message that, first of all, you're going to be forced to go into exile. Exile is to come, but a remnant will return. So judgment is coming, but beyond judgment, there's hope. A remnant will return, or Shear Yashub. The name of the other son appears in chapter 8. You read in verse 1, the Lord said, take a large scroll, write on it with an ordinary pen, Maher Shalal Hashbaz, and I will call in Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah as reliable witnesses for me. Then I went to the prophetess, that is his wife. She conceived and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said to me, name him Maher Shalal Hashbaz. end quote. That's a good name if any of you are looking for a name of a son. The meaning of Maher Shalal Hash Baz is, quote, hasten the booty, speed the spoils, end quote. Hasten the booty, speed the spoils. I notice the NIV note here says that it means quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil. Either way, the name carries a message. If you go over to chapter 10, verses 5 and 6, you really get a play on the name of Maher Shalal Hash Baz, because in 5 and 6, Isaiah says, woe to the Assyrian, the rod of my anger, in whose hand is the club of my wrath. I send him against a godless nation. That is, the Lord is using Assyria against Israel as the rod in his hand to bring judgment and punishment upon Israel. In the latter part of verse 6, we read, quote, I dispatch him against a people who anger me, end quote. Then notice the next phrase, quote, to seize loot and to snatch plunder, end quote. They're the same words as Maher Shalal Hash Baz, that is, to seize loot and snatch plunder. The Assyrians are going to come and plunder Israel, to trample them down like mud in the streets. But this is not what the Assyrians intend. In other words, the Assyrian is looking out for his own interest, but behind Assyria's own interest, God is using Assyria as an instrument of judgment. So the name Maher Shalal Hash Baz is really anticipating that judgment is coming at the hands of the Assyrians upon Judah. Now, Isaiah prophesied, as you know, from the first verse, during the reigns of various kings of Judah. We quote, the vision concerning Judah and Jerusalem that Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, end quote. So Isaiah prophesied during the times of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah of the southern kingdom, Judah. These reigns are somewhat complex in getting dates because there appears to be a series of co-regencies between fathers and sons. If you want to get into the details of that chronological time period, you are running from 767 BC down to 695 BC, the end of Hezekiah's reign. It is a rather lengthy period of time. However, there is again a Jewish tradition, a rabbinic tradition, that Isaiah was killed in the time of the following king after Hezekiah, that is, in the time of Hezekiah's son, King Manasseh, who, as we know, was a fairly evil king. The Jewish tradition is this. Manasseh was a very evil king, of course, and Isaiah fled from some of Manasseh's men, and he hid in a hollow tree, which his men proceeded to cut down, and in so doing, they cut Isaiah in two. Some see an allusion to that in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, verse 37, where it speaks of these heroes of the faith, and it speaks of being sawn asunder. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 37 says, quote, they were stoned, they were sawed in two, they were put to death by the sword, they went about in sheepskins and goatskins, end quote. Now, the interesting thing about that tradition is that it still sees Isaiah around in the time of King Manasseh, even though that superscription in Isaiah says that Isaiah preached only during the time of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. It seems that there is still a basis to conclude that Isaiah did survive past the end of Hezekiah's reign and did live in the time of Manasseh. The reason I say that is that in chapter 37, verse 38, you read, quote, one day while he was worshiping in the temple of his god Nishrak, he's speaking of Sennacherib, the Assyrian king here, his sons Adramelech and Sharazar cut him down with the sword, and they escaped to the land of Ararat, and Esarhaddon his son succeeded him as king. End quote. The succession of Esarhaddon came after Sennacherib's death, and we know from Assyrian records that Sennacherib died in 681 BC, and that's a pretty firm date. So you can see from this that it is into the time of Manasseh that Isaiah is preaching. Again, whether we have co-regency or sole reign, that's into the time of Manasseh, quite clearly, that Isaiah is giving messages or living. Now, many feel that perhaps the reason that Manasseh is not mentioned in the heading of chapter 1, verse 1 of Isaiah is that subsequent to the death of Hezekiah, who was a very godly king, and the beginning of the reign of Manasseh, who was a very wicked king, that Isaiah's public ministry ceased. In fact, many feel that maybe, and this is speculation, of course, but many feel that maybe that the second part of the book of Isaiah, chapters 40 to 66, which begins to speak about deliverance from exile, were written then, during this time. With the coming of Manasseh, the certainty of the judgment of the exile was clear. In fact, the book of Kings tells us that even after the time of Manasseh, when you had a reformation under the time of King Josiah, it was too little too late. Because of the wickedness of Manasseh, the judgment on Judah was inevitable. It could not be avoided. They would go into exile. Many feel that what Isaiah did after the death of Hezekiah was withdraw from his public ministry and maybe had a more private kind of ministry to the godly element or to, quote, the remnant, end quote, of Judah. Then he produces prophecies about deliverance from exile that was certain to come, and these prophecies would have been a comfort and provided a basis for hope for those godly people that remained in the land. But it seems clear that Isaiah did live on into the reign of Manasseh, even though Manasseh is not mentioned in the heading for the book of Isaiah. Now, capital B of the outline is, quote, the historical setting for the book, end quote. In chapter 6, with that well-known vision of Isaiah, you have a date. You read, quote, and I'm quoting now from chapter 6, verse 1, "In the year that King Judah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted," end quote. We know that the year that King Uzziah died was 739 B.C. That's an important date in this sense that the death of Uzziah really marked the end of a period of prosperity and political strength for Judah. Remember that during the time of Uzziah, over Judah in the south, Israel in the north was also quite prosperous. It paralleled the time of Jeroboam II. Jeroboam II, king of Israel, would have been just about 752 B.C. With Jeroboam II, the northern kingdom had a great time of prosperity. But that period was ending. Assyria had really threatened Israel. We discussed this last quarter with the background to the book of Jonah. Assyria had threatened Israel about a century earlier during the time of Ahab, and subsequently in the time of Jehu, who destroyed the dynasty of Ahab. Remember, Jehu, king of Israel, the northern kingdom, was around 840 BC, about a century earlier. Jehu paid tribute to Shalmaneser of Assyria. During Shalmaneser III's reign, there's a black obelisk that has a picture of Jehu paying tribute to Shalmaneser, king of Assyria. Assyria threatened Judah at that time, but then Assyria had gone into decline. Assyria was pressed from the north by the Urartu people. For a time, Syria gave Israel trouble. Not Assyria, but Syria, the latter which is better called Aram. Damascus, the capital of Syria, or Aram, had threatened Israel. But Syria, or Aram, was also weakened so that when you come to the time of Uzziah and Jeroboam II, there was a period of power and prosperity for Israel and for Judah because both Syria and Assyria were weak. But that was all ending. Assyria was now again to rise to power and attempt to extend her influence and control over other peoples. And that began with Tiglath-Pileser III, whose dates are 745 to 727 B.C. Tiglath-Pileser III begins what's known as the Neo-Assyrian Empire. You have this succession of rulers in Assyria, therefore. We start out with Tiglath-Pileser III, followed by Shalmaneser V, Sargon II, and then Sennacherib, the king who would later attack Judah and Hezekiah. From Assyrian records, we learn that Tiglath-Pileser fought in northern Syria against a league of kings, among whom was, quote, Aziahu of Judah, end quote. Most people think that this is Uzziah. Now, Uzziah had two names. Sometimes he was called Azariah, either Azariah or Uzziah. Many think Ahaziahu in the Assyrian record maybe was Uzziah. It's not absolutely certain, but many think that it was Azariah or Uzziah, king of Judah, that joined the coalition of kings that fought against Tiglath-Pileser in northern Syria. Tiglath-Pileser says that these kings against whom he fought were forced to pay tribute. From the Assyrian records, that's dated 743 BC. Now, there's nothing said of that in the Old Testament, but in 743, it says that Tiglath-Pileser took tribute from a coalition of kings, among whom perhaps was Uzziah. That is the third year of Tiglath-Pileser's reign. See, that's early on in the reign of Tiglath-Pileser. In another of his annals, he speaks of taking tribute from Menahem of Samaria. Menahem was king of the northern kingdom, Samaria. You see, if you go over to the northern kingdom, that's the same time. So if you look at 2 Kings, chapter 15, verse 19, here you have to do a biblical reference, you read that, quote, "Then Pul," which was the Babylonian name for Tiglath-Pileser, Tiglath-Pileser being the Assyrian name, the Babylonians called him Pul, and he's referred to as Pul here in the account in Kings. We read, "Then Pul, king of Assyria, invaded the land, and Menahem gave him 1,000 talents of silver to gain his support and strengthen his own hold on the kingdom." End quote. Menahem exacted the money from Israel. The year of that is not known precisely, but Albright, the great archaeologist, puts it at 738 BC. Tilly, who writes the chronology of the kings of Israel and Judah, puts that date at 743. Whatever the case, you can see that under Tiglath-Pileser, pressure again is beginning to be exerted on Israel from the Assyrians. Tiglath-Pileser says in his own accounts, quote, "As for Menahem, I overwhelmed him, and he fled like a bird. Alone I returned him to his place. Gold, silver, linen garments, and multicolored trimmings I received from him." End quote. If you look at your bibliography under Roman numeral 1, capital D, I have that text from Ancient Near Eastern Text, or so-called Anet, A-N-E-T, which are the texts by James C. Pritchard that have relevance to Old Testament history. It is the standard collection of extra-biblical texts from the ancient Near East. Now, on pages 25 to 29, if you want to look at some of the Assyrian annals of time, that's where you will find what I just quoted. The point is that at the time of Uzziah, early in the ministry of Isaiah, Assyria begins to rise to power and begins to put pressure on both the northern and the southern kingdoms of Israel. The next significant thing, as far as historical context is concerned, is the date 734 BC, the Syro-Ephraimitic War. The Syro-Ephraimitic War is when Syria, or Aram, and Ephraim, the northern kingdom, attacked Judah, and that's the historical background for the prophecies in Isaiah chapter 7 through 11. Israel and Syria attacked Judah with the purpose of putting a puppet king on the throne of Judah and getting rid of Ahaz. If you turn to Isaiah chapter 7, you read in verse 5, quote, Aram, let me make a comment on that. When you read the NIV, you will read Aram. When you read the King James, you will read Aram translated as Syria. They're the same thing as I mentioned earlier. Aram is really better, I think, because that's the way it appears in Hebrew. In Hebrew, it is the word Aram. The term Syria is a shortened form of Assyria. The title Syria really comes from Greek terminology when Alexander the Great and his forces came east. They came into the western part of what had been Assyria, the land around Damascus. The Greeks called it Syria, a shortened form of Assyria. That terminology came down through tradition into the English version. But I think many people confuse Syria and Assyria, which is very easy to do, so it's probably better and certainly closer to the Hebrew terminology to speak of the area around Damascus as Aram, and the area farther to the east in the Tigris-Euphrates area as Assyria, which was in the northern part of the Tigris-Euphrates area. Now, with that as background, let's go to Isaiah chapter 7, verse 5, which says, quote, Aram, Ephraim, and Remaliah's son have plotted your ruin, saying, Let us invade Judah, let us tear it apart, and divide it among ourselves, and make the son of Tabeel king over it. Yet this is what the sovereign Lord says, It will not take place. End quote. What is being referred to here is this attempt by the northern kingdom, which here is referred to as Ephraim, or Ephraim, and Syria, Aram, who wanted to put their own king on the throne of Judah in place of Ahaz. Ahaz, of course, is very concerned about this. What Ahaz did in order to avoid this was to seek help from the Assyrians, and Isaiah is condemning him for it. That's the context of chapter 7. Isaiah says that dependence on Assyria ultimately is going to bring trouble and sorrow, and eventually Assyria, whom Ahaz turned to, is going to take the northern kingdom into exile and then put pressure on the southern kingdom of Judah. That was realized not long after this. When you look around the time of 734 BC, the Syro-Ephraimitic War takes place, and in 721 BC, Samaria is completely defeated by Assyria. And it's not too long after that that Sennacherib is laying siege to Jerusalem in 701 BC. And if it wasn't for God's intervention, Judah would have been gone too. So that alliance with Assyria was certainly a disastrous thing, that alliance that was initiated by Ahaz, king of Judah. The next important event after 734 BC, the Syro-Ephraimitic War, was, as far as historical background for the messages of Isaiah concerned, is 732, 2 years later, when Damascus was captured by Assyria. In 732, Tiglath-Pileser took Damascus, but he didn't take the northern kingdom of Israel immediately. Look at 2 Kings chapter 15, verse 29. Quote, In the time of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and took Ijon, Abel-Beth-Maacah, Yanoah, Kedesh, and Hazor. End quote. Those are areas way in the north of Israel. He took Gilead and Galilee, including all the land of Naphtali, and deported the people to Assyria. We quote again, Then Hoshea, son of Elah, conspired against Pekah, son of Remaliah. He attacked and assassinated him, and then succeeded him as king in the 20th year of Jotham, son of Uzziah. End quote. And this is 2 Kings chapter 15, verse 30. So you have a succession by virtue of authority of revolution and intrigue where Hoshea, the northern king, conspires against Pekah, who is king at that time, and takes the throne in Samaria. Now the interesting thing is that ancient Near Eastern text, or Anat, when you look at the annals of Tiglath-Pileser, he says that he put Hoshea on the throne in Israel. Now you see, that gives you somewhat of a fuller picture of what's going on here in verse 30 of 2 Kings chapter 15, where it says, quote, Hoshea, son of Elah, conspired against Pekah, end quote. But he must have done that with Assyrian backing. So Hoshea was Assyria's puppet on the throne of Israel, the northern kingdom. Tiglath-Pileser makes a claim in this in his annals, that he's the one who put Hoshea on the throne of Israel. But what you see is that Assyria is beginning to move. They captured Damascus, and they're moving west, putting pressure on the northern kingdom of Israel, taking some of the towns and even disrupting the rule there by putting their own person, their puppet king, on the throne of the northern kingdom. The next important event, and it would be 10 years later, is the capture of Samaria by Assyria. That's the downfall of the northern kingdom. Hoshea apparently was put on the throne by Tiglath-Pileser, but after a time he revolted, and that caused Shalmaneser, who was Tiglath-Pileser's successor, and then his successor Sargon, to besiege Samaria for 3 years. You read of that in 2 Kings chapter 17, beginning in verse 3. Quote, Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up to attack Hoshea, who had been Shalmaneser's vassal, and had paid him tribute. But the king of Assyria discovered that Hoshea was a traitor, for he had sent envoys to So, king of Egypt, and he no longer paid tribute to the king of Assyria as he had done year by year. Therefore, Shalmaneser seized him and put him in prison. The king of Assyria invaded the entire land, marched against Samaria, and laid siege to it for 3 years. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and deported the Israelites to Assyria. He settled them in Hala. End quote. And then verse 7 says of 2 Kings chapter 17, quote, all this took place because the Israelites had sinned against the Lord their God. End quote. That is, they had broken the covenant. If you go over to chapter 18 in 2 Kings again, which is a discussion of the rule of Hezekiah of the southern kingdom, you notice verse 9 says, quote, in King Hezekiah's 4th year, which was the 7th year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, marched against Samaria and laid siege to it. At the end of 3 years, the Assyrians took it. So Samaria was captured in Hezekiah's 6th year, which was the 9th year of Hoshea, king of Israel. End quote. The next very significant event is 701 BC, and this is the attempt to seize Jerusalem that was done by Sennacherib, king of Assyria. See, if you go down to verse 13 of that chapter, we read, quote, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, attacked all the fortified cities of Judah and captured them. End quote. And then over in 2 Kings chapter 19, towards the end of the chapter, you read of the siege of Jerusalem by Sennacherib and of the intervention of God to deliver the city. You read in 2 Kings chapter 19, verse 35. I quote, that night the angel of the Lord went out and put to death 185,000 men in the Assyrian camp. When the people got up the next morning, there were all these dead bodies around. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, broke camp and withdrew. He returned to Nineveh and stayed there. End quote. So in 701 BC, there was a siege of Jerusalem, but there was divine intervention to deliver the city, which had been prophesied, by the way, as we noted in Isaiah. Now, Isaiah had prophesied long before that, when Ahaz made that alliance with Assyria, that Assyria is going to overflow the land like a flood, but in the midst of that flood, there's going to be deliverance. And you find later, even in Isaiah's life, during the time of Hezekiah, a fulfillment of the prophecies that Isaiah made in the context of the alliance with the Assyrian king. In verse 15 of chapter 18, we read, quote, Hezekiah gave him, that is the king of Assyria, all the silver that was found in the temple. End quote. Well, this seems like what you see often in politics and in relations like that. There's just greed. The Assyrians will take what they can get, but it's never enough. They'll just want to take more in spite of the pain of the tribute to them. Now, what may be involved as well is, Hezekiah, even though he paid the tribute, made certain overtures to Babylon, which was generally under Assyrian control at that time, but still a distinct element, distinct district within the Assyrian area of control. That overture to Babylon may have been interpreted by Assyria as a revolt by King Hezekiah, and that's what prompted Sennacherib's attack, even though Hezekiah had paid tribute to him. There are a lot of difficult problems of chronology in putting together the accounts of Hezekiah's relationship with Assyria. There's a historical parallel to this in Isaiah chapter 36 to 39. It seems quite clear that the sequence of these narratives was arranged more on a topical or logical basis than it is on a chronological basis. So part of the problem, I think, is sorting out what is the exact sequence of the events we have been discussing. You see in the Isaiah account that an envoy from Babylon comes at the end, which, in light of what we're saying, that was after the tribute was all gone. What would there have been left to show? But it seems that the envoy from Babylon must have come earlier, and it's put in the end of this section of Isaiah, in order to make the transition in the flow of thought to the second part of the book, where Israel is in Babylonian captivity. So you see, in the first part of the section of Isaiah, chapters 36 to 39, Assyria is the major foreign element, whereas towards the end, it's Babylon. And what we have is a nice transition then between the troubles of Assyria and the exile into Babylon. It appears to be a logical sequence more than a chronological sequence. Be it what it may be, it seems like there is more of a logical ordering to the material than there is a chronological ordering to these events, as discussed in Isaiah chapter 36 to 39. Now, I'm not sure I can sort all that out for you right here at the moment, but I think that's probably a factor in the questions being asked. In other words, you see in chapter 18 of 2 Kings, those first 16 verses, they give you a summary of the reign of Hezekiah. Then you go back, and when you start in verse 17, Sennacherib threatens Jerusalem. You have an account of that specific event. That may chronologically fit differently in that whole flow of things. It's not necessary, but it happens subsequent to everything else that has happened. But in spite of Hezekiah's chronology, here are key dates to keep in mind. 734, the Syro-Ephraimite War against Judah. 732, Damascus is captured by Assyria. 721, or some people put 722, Samaria falls. And in 701, Sennacherib attacks Hezekiah's Judah. When we move beyond that, we come into the time of Manasseh. That was a great time of apostasy in the southern kingdom. Manasseh was pictured as the absolute worst of the kings of Judah. During the time of Manasseh, the exile of Judah becomes certain and unavoidable. And it seems that it's at that time that Isaiah turns his message to the godly remnant to bring words of comfort, consolation, and hope, and looking beyond the judgment that was sure to come. In other words, the exile is definite, but it is not forever. There will be an end to it. There will be a remnant that will return. That's in general the historical settings for the prophecies of Isaiah. Let's go on now to capital C of the outline, which is, quote, the structure of the book, end quote. Isaiah is a difficult book to outline. I'm following here a system that I picked up from Dr. Alan McRae, president of Biblical Theological Seminary, to try to find some principle of organization of the book. That is, to break it down into the blocks of material that can be found within the whole of the book. The book contains 66 chapters, so that the first line on the board of the outline that I have represents the book of Isaiah. If you're going to start dividing the book, there's a major dividing point, and that is this section, chapters 36 to 39, which we've discussed before, because chapters 36 to 39 form a distinctly different group and from the rest of the book. Chapters 36 to 39 is historical narrative. In fact, it parallels the historical narrative in the book of the Kings at the time of Hezekiah and the threat of Sennacherib. Isaiah 36 to 39 and that section of 2 Kings right around chapters 17 and 18 is what we've just been looking at. They're very similar. So that is a distinct section that naturally divides the book into two parts, to wit, chapters 1 to 35, then chapters 36 to 39, and finally chapters 40 to 66. 1 to 35 and 40 to 66, both being prophetic discourse, as distinct from the historical narrative that we find in chapters 36 to 39 of Isaiah. Now, most of the material of chapters 1 to 35 is made up of discourses given in the time of Ahaz or even prior. Some of them are from the time of Uzziah. So chapters 1 to 35 is early in the ministry of Isaiah, you might say, or relatively early, most of it around the time of Ahaz. Chapters 36 to 39, it's not prophetic discourse, but historical narrative. And as we've mentioned several times before, this is dealing with the situation around the time of Hezekiah. What you see in chapters 36 to 39 is really the fulfillment of some of Isaiah's prophecies in the first part of the book, particularly that prophecy that even though Assyria is going to come in and be an instrument of God's judgment, Assyria is not going to completely overrun the whole of the land, and it doesn't. Isaiah said Assyria would attack, but Judah would be spared of complete defeat, and that's exactly what happened. It's recorded in that section of chapters 36 to 39. You see how Isaiah's prophecy earlier about Assyria worked out historically. I'll come back to say something about chapters 40 to 66 later, but let's look with this section, chapters 1 to 35, and try to break it down further. I think if you do, you'll find that the most natural divisions are as follows. Chapters 1 to 6 formed a sort of unit in its own right, then chapters 7 to 12, then chapters 13 to 23, then 24 to 27, then 28 to 35. Let me give those again, chapters 1 to 6, 7 to 12, 13 to 23, 24 to 27, and finally 28 to 35. Those are the divisions. Now, what sets each one of these divisions apart? Let's look at them individually. I'd say the clearest units are chapters 13 to 23 and chapters 24 to 27. That's why I set them above the line that I have on the board. Chapters 13 to 23 are a group of prophecies of judgments on foreign nations. So in that section, Isaiah is not directing his message so much to Israel itself, but to the surrounding entities, the surrounding nations. If you look at chapter 13, verse 1, you can see how this works out quite quickly. Quote, "An oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw." End quote. Look at Isaiah chapter 15, verse 1. Quote, "An oracle concerning Moab," end quote. Then in chapter 17, quote, "An oracle concerning Damascus," end quote. Chapter 18, quote, "Woe to the land of whirling wings along the rivers of Cush, which sends envoys by sea in papyrus boats over the water," end quote. It's a prophecy against Cush. Cush is probably what we call modern-day Ethiopia to the south of Egypt. In chapter 19, we read, quote, "An oracle concerning Egypt," end quote. So you see here in this section of prophecies concerning foreign nations, and that is what sets them apart as a unique section. When you get to chapters 24 to 27, that section is called, quote, "Isaiah's Little Apocalypse," end quote. What you see in chapters 24 to 27 is a collection of prophecies that speak of a great judgment that's coming on the nations of the earth. All who oppose God will suffer this judgment. It seems to be quite global in scope. So in that section, we call it Isaiah's Little Apocalypse. These two sections pretty much set themselves apart from chapters 1 to 6, 7 to 12, and 28 to 35. When you come then to this section, chapters 1 to 35, the clear section is probably chapters 7 to 12. When you've pulled out chapters 13 to 23 and chapters 24 to 27, that leaves you with chapters 1 to 12. But out of chapters 1 to 12, chapters 7 to 12 is a clear unit. Chapters 7 to 12 concern that Syro-Ephraimitic war and its aftermath that we discussed earlier. In chapter 7, the Lord says to Isaiah, "Take your son Shear-Yashub, go out and meet Ahaz, and confront him about this alliance he's made with Assyria. Instead of trusting me, he's trusting in Assyria. Judgment is pronounced because of that." So chapters 7 to 12 have a specific background and historical setting, the Syro-Ephraimitic War of 734 BC, and that sets it apart as a unit. That unit is often called, quote, "the Book of Emmanuel," end quote. The reason for that name is the prophecy of Isaiah 7:14. Because in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, in the context of the Syro-Ephraimitic War, Isaiah says, quote, "The Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel," end quote. A lot of interesting questions arise about how you interpret that prophecy, how you relate it to that context and at that time, and how you see it as a messianic prophecy. We'll get into all that. That well-known verse, Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, has given a title to this section, chapters 7 to 12, because it's right at the heart of that section, and so we call it the Book of Emmanuel. That leaves the opening chapters 1 to 6. And 1 to 6 is pretty much general in nature. You can't pin it down to a specific historical setting as you can chapters 7 to 12 with that Syro-Ephraimitic War, despite the general nature. But chapters 1 to 6 divides into three sections, and we're going to look at these, at the character of the three sections. The three sections are chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 2, verse 5, chapter 2, verse 6 to chapter 4, verse 6, and chapter 5, verse 1 to chapter 6, verse 13. The character of those three sections is that you have a pronouncement of judgment followed by a section that speaks of future blessing. In the outline that I've handed out, the section that speaks of future blessing is in parentheses. You see this in chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 2, verse 5. Chapter 2, 1 to 4, speaks of future blessing. You have judgment, then future blessing. Then you go back in chapter 2, verse 6 to judgment again, but that's followed in chapter 4, verses 2 to 6, with another section of future blessing. And then finally, if you go to chapter 5, verse 1, you have judgment, but that's followed by chapter 6, verses 1 to 6, by blessing. The latter blessings in that case being the call of Isaiah and the vision he sees, and permission to bring the word of the Lord to the people of Israel. So you see, the character of that material is judgment, blessing, judgment, blessing, judgment, blessing. We'll look at the three sections in more detail and see how that works out, but that's the way Isaiah is structured in these chapters. That gives you, then, the way in which the material from chapter 1 to chapter 35 is organized. You really break it down into these five sections. The prophecies are grouped around some kind of principle of organization, like prophecies against four nations: this eschatological, apocalyptic judgment, the Syro-Ephraimitic War, properties of judgment, and then blessing. Chapters 28 to 35 is much like chapters 7 to 12, and it seems like it has the same general historical background for chapters 28 to 35, shares the Syro-Ephraimitic War as its historical background. But it seems like whereas chapters 7 to 32 is addressed more to the king, Ahaz, who really is an unworthy representative of the house of David sitting on the throne of Judah, chapters 28 to 35 is addressed more to the nobles of the land, the leadership apart from the king, but it's very similar to the book of Emmanuel. So that's the section, chapters 1 to 35. That's how we break it apart. We notice that chapters 36 to 39 is historical narrative. And then you get to chapters 40 to 66, the last 27 chapters of the book. And the interesting thing here is that this material is in some respects quite different. Of course, that's the kind of thing that critical scholars use to suggest that we have a different writer altogether here. This material is quite different. Assyria, that is so prominent in the first part of the book, is now hardly mentioned. In this section, the prophet turns his attention away from the sad conditions in Israel at the time of Manasseh and Ahaz, and he's looking forward not just to exile, but looking forward to release from exile, assuming that exile has already taken place. So Isaiah sees the exile as absolutely certain. And what he's concerned with in the second part of the book is not so much the coming of the exile, but with the end of the exile. His focus is on the fact that the exile is not going to be forever. There will be deliverance. There will be return to Judah. But what that means is, whereas the first part of the book, chapters 1 to 35, is concerned with warnings of coming judgment and call to repentance, the second part of the book has a quite different emphasis. That warning of coming judgment is not emphasized at all in the second part of the book. You have material of comfort, consolation, a future hope beyond exile. So it seems that Isaiah is now speaking to believers, giving them something to be passed on that would be of value, and giving encouragement and hope to their descendants who actually experienced those conditions of exile and judgment about which he prophesied earlier. Now, it's interesting that in this section, the 13th chapter, which is Isaiah 53, we're talking about the 13th chapter of the section 42, the end of the book. So chapter 40 plus 13 is Isaiah 53. And that's what I mean when I say in this particular section, when you look at the 13th chapter, it is the central chapter of the 27 chapters of Isaiah, chapters 40 to 66. It's right in the middle of this section that you have a climax towards which everything previous moves to and from which everything subsequent is based on. Right in the heart of this section, 40 to 66, is Isaiah 53. And as I said, it's right in the center. What that portrays is the suffering of Christ, the suffering of the servant. It's in the climax of the section of servant passages, but it depicts the sufferings of Christ for the salvation of those who believe in him, and it does it in a beautifully clear way. Now, that brings up a question that I think is an important one and an interesting one, and that question is, how does that messianic theme, that is, the suffering of the servant, how does that relate to this whole focus of this section of Isaiah on deliverance from exile? What's the relationship between the exile and this servant theme that climaxes in the death of this servant on behalf of the people? Great question, but we'll have to look at that next time. This ends Dr. Robert Vinoy's lecture number one on the major prophets, the prophet Isaiah in this case.